Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztrauber. On today's show, Spokio. This case at the Supreme Court recently came down, and Spokio is a search engine for people. But unlike your phone book or the white pages, Spokio claims to glean its information from public databases, such as your social media profile. So when the site allegedly posted false information about a man named Thomas Robbins, he sued. And on May 16th, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Spokio v. Robbins, the latest in a line of cases where the court tries to flesh out when a plaintiff is allowed to sue in federal court, that is, whether the plaintiff has so-called standing. Joining me to discuss this is Adam J. White, research fellow at the Hoover Institution and of counsel at Boyd & Gray & Associates, where he represented Tech Freedom in the Open Internet Order case over the FCC's net neutrality regulations. Adam, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly is Robbins alleging that Spokio did to him that would warrant a lawsuit in a federal court?
Well, Robbins is alleging that Spokio holds itself out as a database on all the relevant information about a person's personal details, including their creditworthiness. And in this case, he says, Spokio just has me wrong. The information that they've published about me, my demographic information, where I've lived and so on, it's just incorrect. Now, he hasn't said, as I understand it, he hasn't said where the search was run, who ran the search, or how he found out that the information about him was wrong. But he says, the information that you have about me is wrong, and that violates the Fair Credit Reporting Act, a federal statute that requires consumer reporting agencies, and it's alleged here that Spokio is a consumer reporting agency. The act requires those to do the best they can to take all reasonable measures to maintain the maximum accuracy of information about creditworthiness. He says in this case, Spokio, you haven't done that. You've violated the statute, and the statute gives me a right to sue. So here I am.
Hypothetically, how could information, Spokio, it's dealing with things like zip codes and phone numbers and where you live and where you work, basically things that can be ripped off of your LinkedIn page, your Twitter, whatever else the site can find. And we're not exactly sure how it works, but that's generally been my experience when brief experiences on the site. So how are these things impacting your credit score? How is a site like this called a credit reporting agency?
Well, okay, there's a couple of questions there. First of all, the easy one is there's a statutory definition for credit for a consumer reporting agency. I don't have it right in front of me, but it spells out what a CRA is. And Spokio, in this case, the information that they set forth, it seems a credible claim that they qualify as a consumer reporting agency. Now, maybe that means the statute is too broadly written in this day and age, but at least that's what Robbins has alleged. And I have to say, speaking as someone with a name like Adam White, who doesn't have the sort of distinct name that you have, I can sympathize with someone like Thomas Robbins, who finds that the information that Spokio puts forward for him is probably mixed up in some cases with other Thomas Robbinses, Thomas Robbinses with much less creditworthiness, evidently, and who've lived in, worse zip codes or whatever. How does that information affect your creditworthiness? Well, banks have long tried to understand, take guess at your creditworthiness based on where you live, what sort of jobs you've had, what your other interests are, I suppose, in this day and age. And so you put all that together in an algorithm, and maybe that's how banks sort of judge your creditworthiness. Zip codes actually could be sort of impactful. But in this case, as I understand it, he hasn't alleged all that much about it yet, which is why the case is going to go back down to the lower courts.
And one thing that came to mind, or two things actually, are libel and Section 230. And these are Section 230 is something we talked about on the show before. That's the law that arguably allowed things like Google, Facebook to succeed. It's an intermediary liability law that basically says that if someone posts something on Google or Facebook that's not true, it's the person, if anyone, who's going to be responsible for posting it, not the website. Now, I guess in this case, because Spokio is not a Web 2.0 situation where people are uploading content, they are doing the aggregation. That's why 230 doesn't apply here.
Well, that, and also I suspect it's because here you have a specific statute that actually does impose direct liability on people that are undertaking certain services. And so,
it's worth noting that this statute was passed in 1970 before the internet. And I'm not saying that doesn't mean it shouldn't apply, but it is an older law that did not necessarily contemplate a company like Spokio.
Right. And I think that's one of the reasons why this case has attracted so much interest. I mean, setting aside the libel laws or Section 230, there's any number of statutes, old and new, that are out there with liability provisions sort of laying out there like loaded handguns just waiting to be picked up by a class action lawyer. And I think that's why companies like eBay and Google were particularly interested in this case and concerned about the way that the court's standing jurisprudence might go if they open the door broadly to lawsuits lacking a concrete showing of injury.
So yeah, we'll get to the kind of implications of the bigger picture in a little bit, but just to start, what initially happened with the lawsuit? As I understand it, it didn't get far, but then it got reinvigorated and then it went to the court. So just kind of give us a replay of what happened after Robbins sued.
Sure. So, and just to remind the listeners again, so you had the statute that said that consumer reporting agencies need to basically take all reasonable steps to ensure maximum accuracy of their information about creditworthiness. After someone ran a search, we don't know who, after Robbins learned that his information was inaccurate, he filed a federal lawsuit. Under a statute, another provision of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, that says that if your rights are violated by a consumer reporting agency, if they fail to satisfy the requirements of the act, then affected individuals can sue in federal court for significant damages. And when you turn it into a class action lawsuit, where one plaintiff is representing thousands, millions of people that are similarly situated, you're talking real money. Even for Google and Facebook, real money. And so he files this lawsuit in federal district court. The federal court looks at his complaint, looks at the standards of standing, which we'll get into, and says, no, you haven't shown that you're really injured by what you're complaining about. Yeah, maybe Spokio arguably violated the law, but even if they did, you need to show that you're injured in a concrete way. So he appeals up to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. And the Ninth Circuit looks at his pleadings and says, no, there's enough here. You've shown that your information is wrong, that the company has violated the law, the statute, in a way that's particular to you. It's not just some sort of broad violation of the law. And so that's enough for you to have standing to sue. And that's what brought this case to the Supreme Court because, and we'll get into this, but specifically Spokio said, well, even if you've shown that your injury, your alleged injury, is particularized, you've shown that it affects you or it pertains to you personally, you haven't shown that you've been injured in a real concrete way. And that's an important buzzword in the Supreme Court's standing jurisprudence. They said you haven't shown a concrete injury, therefore you lack standing, therefore this case should go away. The Ninth Circuit disagreed, and that's what brought this to the Supreme Court.
So clearly the real crux of the issue is this issue of standing, whether you have a right to even be in the courtroom, whether this affects you in a kind of a personal way, and then the word concrete. Can you give some examples of particular injuries that are not concrete or things that are both particular and concrete, just to kind of give the listeners a sense of the array of different injuries that the court has to look at and rule on?
Sure. Well, an injury for purposes of standing, you know, the classic examples are, say, financial injury or physical injury. But there are other non-financial, non-physical injuries. A violation of your First Amendment rights, right, might give you a right to sue the government. Let me just back up a step and put this into broader context to where all this is coming from. Okay, so federal courts, they don't have open-ended jurisdiction, like a lot of state courts do. The U.S. Constitution gives the courts jurisdiction over certain cases and controversies. There's a laundry list of cases and controversies. But the Supreme Court in the last three decades has tried to boil this down into a number of tests. And one of them is the test for standing. To sue in federal court, you have to show you have standing. There's three parts to this. You have to show that you have an injury, that the injury is caused by the person you're suing, the conduct that you're suing over. And finally, the third factor is that the court can grant you relief that actually fixes that injury.
Yeah, and that's an important one because you could see a situation where I was harmed and the person I'm suing did harm me, but that the court is in no way going to be able to fix the harm. Either it's too late or there's nothing they could possibly do that would fix the situation, so there's no purpose to it.
That's right. Exactly. And so again, the three tests, the three factors are actual injury. Is it caused by the defendant? Is it redressable by the court? So you zero in on that first factor, actual injury. And the court has spelled that out in a little bit more detail. They say your injury has to be actual. It has to be immediate or imminent. It has to be concrete and particularized, not just conjectural or hypothetical. You have to be talking about something real. So you come down a little bit more narrowly on concrete and particularized. Those are the two buzzwords that are at issue in this case. Again, there was no real dispute that the injury here is particular. The injury that's alleged is particularized. Robbins is talking about something that Spokio did with respect to him,
the search results for him. Right, it was his information, right?
That's right. It wasn't just they have, you know, incorrect information about sort of something in general. You know, you're not complaining about a Wikipedia entry about a sports team. You're talking about Spokio's search results about you.
Right.
And so that's particularized. But then the question is, did he need to show that the injury was actually concrete? And so in the Supreme Court's decision last week, they get into what does concrete mean? And it's a little confusing at times because right off the bat, they say a concrete injury doesn't necessarily have to be tangible. Now, that's as far as metaphors goes, you're already sort of at a dead end, right? Because what's more tangible than concrete? But they say no. They say concrete can be something intangible. It can be a violation of rights that Congress has said you have a right to sue over if the injury is concrete, if it somehow is really directly manifested in a real world way that actually affects you. It's not just some hypothetical injury you're complaining about, but it's something that actually sort of it exists in a very real way for the affected plaintiff.
Now, you brought up the example of free speech and your free speech rights being violated. That, in my mind, is kind of an intangible thing, but maybe the courts view that differently, that because free speech is spelled out in the Constitution, that is much more tangible, whereas your right to not have an algorithm mistakenly put information in a certain, that's kind of it's more murky. And is that why that's intangible as opposed to the First Amendment, which the only thing that kind of makes it tangible is that it's written down somewhere?
Well, and here's where the language the court used gets a little confusing, right? The court said, no, a First Amendment injury would be tangible.
Right.
Right. Or it would be concrete even if it's intangible. Sorry. Now I'm doing it too. They said, if the federal government is restraining your speech, that's a concrete injury, even though it's not about a tangible sort of physical or financial
right.
loss.
It's abstract.
It's abstract, but it's real.
Yeah.
Which again is sort of a bad way of putting it, but it's real enough. It's real enough that it's deeply felt in a real and personal way.
Yeah.
And in this case, in the Spokio case, the court actually, at the end of its opinion, does try to tease out what may or may not be a concrete injury here. They said, you know, just a editing mistake in your zip code, they said, wouldn't necessarily be concrete. They wouldn't get into what other information Spokio has that would or would not give rise to a concrete injury. But they said right off the bat, you know, a wrong zip code in and of itself probably isn't a concrete injury. But we'll reserve judgment on what else would be a concrete injury, and we'll let the Ninth Circuit and the Federal District Court sort it out first.
So basically, because the Ninth Circuit failed to do that analysis, failed to figure out whether it was concrete, applying those tests that you brought up earlier, the Supreme Court basically said, just do this again, but we're not interested in being the final ruler on the subject.
Well, they might be the final ruler, but they won't be the first one, right? They're, like you said, the Ninth Circuit, they analyzed whether the injury was particularized, but not whether it was concrete. So the Supreme Court told them, do this over.
Yeah, go do your job.
Yeah, you only had one job. Go do your job. And so now it'll go down to the Ninth Circuit and maybe all the way back down to the Federal District Court to apply this test for the first time to the facts at hand. Now, interestingly, at the Supreme Court, two justices dissented. Ginsburg wrote a dissent that was joined by, I believe, Sotomayor. Obviously, there's already enough facts here. We can apply the test here. There's no reason to send it all back down for a total do-over. This can be done right now. And they seemed pretty pretty inclined to find that there is a concrete injury here. But at the very least, you get the sense that they thought it'd be a total waste of time to send it all back down again.
Now, of course, it's impossible to talk about the Supreme Court without talking about the left-right divide. Mm-hmm. And right now, after the passing of Justice Scalia, for the purposes of making it simple, we've got basically four conservative justices, four liberal justices. One of the conservatives is kind of libertarian. Anthony Kennedy made gay marriage legal in all 50 states, et cetera. Is there a split here because of the, you know, general free market approach that conservatives have? They're much less skeptical of things that private companies do. They're much more willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. Whereas maybe the liberal justices are more privacy conscious. They see this as a privacy violation, even if it's not something codified like the First Amendment. Are we seeing that kind of split in the dissent and concurrence?
I mean, the point's well taken that in a lot of these doctrines, there is a right-left split. Although, you know, on privacy, Justice Alito, one of the conservatives, seems a little bit more sensitive to privacy issues than his fellow conservatives are. And in with standing doctrine in particular, it really did grow out of the conservative part of the court. The late Justice Scalia really is responsible for the reinvigoration of standing doctrine. The famous case that's the basis for all of this, it's called Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife, was a Scalia opinion. And conservatives have, by and large, been responsible for reinvigorating the doctrine and more seriously policing the boundaries of standing, precisely to prevent the courts from becoming sort of political forums. Again, the whole reason for standing, right, is, like I said, it's rooted in Article 3 of the Constitution, but as a policy matter, the purpose it serves is to make sure that the courts are making decisions of law and aren't just wading into every sort of abstract legal or policy dispute. And so oftentimes you do have an ideological breakdown, right? Massachusetts versus EPA was, I think that was a 5-4 decision, the greenhouse gas case, right, where you had the liberal justices largely saying, no, it's fine for Massachusetts to sue the EPA for failing to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And you had conservatives saying, well, no, obviously there's no injury here. There's no standing for Massachusetts.
Right. It's kind of a weird concept that a state would be injured by a federal regulator in a not particular way, I'm guessing. It didn't only affect Massachusetts, I assume.
Right. But, well, then that was the argument. Now, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. There's another interesting standing case in the Supreme Court right now. It's U.S. versus Texas. Texas and other states suing the Obama administration for refusing to enforce certain immigration laws. And there, the ideological tables may be turned. It'll be very interesting to see how it plays out. Now, in this case, Spokio, it wasn't just a clean left-right divide because only Sotomayor and Ginsburg dissented, right? And they weren't even really dissenting over the standard to apply. They were dissenting over how the case ought to follow through after this.
Kind of a procedural matter. They were just basically saying, rather than kick this back down and tell the other courts to go back and do their homework, why don't we just do their homework for them?
That's right. That's right. Or there's, they've done enough homework, we can give them partial credit.
So there's two major tech policy implications that I just want to get to, because you brought up the EPA example, and we talk a lot on the show about surveillance, and surveillance has been challenged in many courts because it's arguably, at least mass indiscriminate surveillance without a warrant is arguably a pretty brazen Fourth Amendment violation. But there was an example that relates to this case with James Clapper, an intelligence official who famously lied to Senator Ron Wyden about mass surveillance, but still gets to keep his job because, you know, government. So there was a case here where people were suing the federal government, and the issue was, do private citizens have standing against the federal government on surveillance? And there's a real issue there. Is just the violation of my right to privacy an injury, or do they have to do something nefarious with the data? So can you just explain how the surveillance case, a particularly interesting issue in tech policy, relates to the Spokio case?
Sure. Well, in Clapper, the court threw the case out for lack of standing, and they said that the plaintiffs who had sued, including, wasn't it Christopher Hitchens? Wasn't he one of the plaintiffs too? The court said, you can't show that you're actually one of the people who's been subject to surveillance.
Yeah, it's tough when it's mass and indiscriminate to be able to prove that my data were vacuumed up by the government. I assume at some point in my life, my data ended up in NSA hands, but how the hell would I prove that?
Right. Well, actually, it's funny you use the term mass and indiscriminate because, you know, in the roots of the standing doctrine cases, going in due process cases going back to the beginning of the 20th century, you know, if your injury is mass and indiscriminate, right, if it affects everybody, that's sort of a classic case where you don't get standing. You have to show that it actually affects you, and again, in not just a concrete but particularized way. In Clapper, the Supreme Court said that none of these people had shown or given any real basis of even indicating that they were one of the people who had been subject to surveillance. So the court threw it out. Now, the federal government immediately turned around and began using that precedent in a bunch of other contexts. And I saw this in a couple of cases that I was involved in when I was still a full-time practicing attorney, representing companies suing agencies, federal agencies. You know, we had a case, a financial regulation case, where we sued the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and the district court said, well, you haven't actually faced an enforcement action yet. The federal government hasn't brought charges against your community bank, so you don't have any standing, you know, under, you know, the CFPB and other, you know, defendants were citing Clapper, and not just in this case, in other cases, basically saying that Clapper now means that you have to show that you really are immediately being enforced against.
And even though the Clapper case is about government surveillance, that same principle could be applied to private surveillance or just data collection by private companies.
Sure. So, you know, in a case like Spokio or any of these cases involving internet companies where they have a customer base of millions upon millions of users, you could see an argument that, you know, having to show that you could see them arguing that you need to show that you're actually the individual subject of the harm. Now, I will say the Supreme Court walked Clapper back a little bit in a case the next year, Susan B. Anthony List, and made clear, no, Clapper was a truly extraordinary case. But no, like you said, there are ramifications in other cases and in non-government cases where the question is, how much of a showing do we need? You don't need to show with absolute certainty that you're being injured and that you're the only one being injured. But if you can't show any certainty that you're being injured and there's millions upon millions of people being allegedly injured, well, then it seems to look less and less like standing. And that's why Google, eBay, and the other companies were really interested in this case. They filed a brief in support of the court taking the case, and then they filed a brief on the merits, really stressing the ramifications that this could have under other statutes and other bases of law on the lawsuit.
And it's really interesting that major players in the online marketplace like Google, Facebook, and eBay are so interested in a case about a relatively obscure company, Spokio. Doing this podcast reminded me what Spokio is. I've encountered Spokio in trying to do traditional white pages type searches for people's phone numbers, which is increasingly useless on the internet because everyone has a cell phone. So I could see why Spokio might have changed their business model to yank data from other places, kind of innovative. But the big question here, because the Supreme Court made that ruling about something being tangible. Does this lower the bar for privacy cases in general? Are we going to see class action lawsuits by millions, billions of Facebook and Google users alleging that privacy violations were or occurred or that their information was mishandled without really having to prove it? I mean, is that why the companies are so concerned?
Yeah, well, this is the worst lawyer answer, right? But the answer is yes and no. This case, you read this opinion from the court, and they really work hard to stress that you can have a concrete injury even though it's not tangible, right? So violation of rights, statutory rights that Congress has created, the court has made clear, yes, those can give rise to a concrete injury. Right. But at the same time, what the court giveth, the court taketh away, because the court's saying you really need to show that it's concrete. Just because Congress has said you have a right to sue over a violation of a statutory right doesn't mean that that meets the requirements of Article III standing. And so we're going to really look at how this alleged violation of a right, a statutory right, affects you in a real and immediate consequential way. And so it opens the door to those sorts of cases, but the door isn't necessarily that big.
Okay. Well, certainly we'll be tracking that. And if this does give rise to mass class action lawsuits against major internet players over privacy violations, that'll certainly be making a lot more news than the Spokio case.
Right. And it's not just privacy violations. I mean, the statutes that they singled out in their briefs were the Wiretap Act, the Stored Communications Act, all these statutes where the court or the Congress has said, you know, the company has certain obligations, and if they don't meet those obligations, of individuals can take them to court.
Right. And there's that major compliance issue, of course. You know, maybe a smaller company would have a harder time complying with these vague requirements than a larger company. But that's it for today's show. My guest has been Adam J. White, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution and of counsel at Boyd & Gray & Associates, where he represented Tech Freedom in the Open Internet Order case, which we're still waiting for a decision on. It could be any Tuesday or Friday until the end of time, it looks like. But Adam, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
Let us know what you think of the show on our Twitter page at Tech Freedom or on Facebook.com/Tech Freedom. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. We're always happy to get your feedback, ideas for shows, guests that you'd like to see. Let us know. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review because it will help others find the show. And thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.